How many of you have read Abolition of Man? Okay, that's great. How many of you have read it more than once? Okay, so it's a little slim volume. This is the edition I have that's pretty dog-eared. I about destroyed it over the years. But you can see it's very small volume, slim volume. With the appendix, it's 100 pages. So it's very small. It's similar to Mere Christianity. If you look at it on your shelf and you have this edition, it's very similar to the Mere Christianity. But what I'm going to try to set up for you today in context is that it's altogether not like any of his other writings. And so if you look at Mere Christianity and you look at the size and have read that, and then you look at the size here and try to read this, it's not the same thing. And I'll explain a little contextually why it's different. So it does take a little bit to work through. So let's just get moving. Abolition of Man, according to C.S. Lewis, in 1955, he said, "This is almost my favorite among all of my books, but in general has been almost totally ignored by the public." He wrote this in a private letter, letters to an American lady, if you've ever read those sections of Lewis's letter. His letters, there's almost more gold in his letters than in some of his writings. The correspondence that C.S. Lewis kept up, both in Europe and across the pond, was amazing. And now we have just the wealth of knowledge of all these compendiums of his letters. So 12 years after he wrote it, he's like, "This is my favorite book, but it hasn't been well received." Well, the lens he was looking through was that it wasn't well received as in the Narnia series, the multi-million issue selling Narnia. When Abolition Man was printed, and we'll explain why this is what about it is interesting in a moment, but the first 800 copies sold out in less than a week. And within the year, there had been 3 additional printings, which all sold out. And it has been continuously in print for 85 years. So it's funny how authors look at their works and what they're comparing to. And it's only post his death, really, that this book has really taken off. In fact, it's one of the more expensive. I looked at maybe buying some, just so some have here, and they're all $15 to $18 for a brand new. The used ones are $12 to $15. So you can tell by the market is rich for this kind of book. It's not a $3 book or a dollar book. And so Lewis, whether or not he felt it had been a bestseller or not, according to some of his other works, it's continuously grown in interest. And so let's talk a little bit about the difference here. In 1898, I'm going to do a little bit what Dan did, just a little bit of context and overview, but then narrow it in and focus in why specifically the context about Abolition of Man is important. And so he was born, remember, in Northern Ireland in 1898. He was born in Belfast. So he's an Irish lad. And several important things happened very early in his life. His mother dies in 1908. And that had a major impact, and it worked through psychologically some of his writings for the rest of his life. From 1910 to 1914, he's in and out of prep schools all over. And, you know, Tolkien and a lot of others write about this. The prep schools, the boarding schools, were not a happy time for him. In fact, he goes on to write later, it was just something to be endured. And we knew all of my mates endured it together, and that's what made it. There was no happiness. There was no hope. We just all had to endure it together. And so it was more the like, we're in this collective action together that made it good. But he was in and out, almost every other year, a brand new school. So there was no consistency. But in 1914, he began a private tutorship under a gentleman named W.T. Kirkpatrick, who they called the Old Knock. And so he ended his, what we would call, high school career with very specific private tutoring. And he lists Kirkpatrick as kind of the one that helped introduce him to literature that ended up what he calls baptizing his imagination. So he was raised in a religious family, but then it was during this time, of in and out of boarding schools that he just rejects any kind of religious understanding or interest or Christian influence. He just rejects it and becomes what he would argue and absorbs an atheistic worldview and just becomes an atheist as a teenager. And so he is an atheist during this entire time, even though being raised in a religious household. He gets a private tutorship under W.T. Kirkpatrick, and then in 1917 is accepted into the University of Oxford. And so again, you know, University of Oxford, 12th century BC, second oldest university system in the world, kind of invented it. The Latin phrase, "The Lord is my light," is their motto, was their motto. They've reworked it in the past decade. But the Lord is my light. And so he gets accepted to University College, Oxford, but he gets, 1917 is when he's accepted. What little thing in the world is going on in 1917 around England? Right? So you're in the middle of the World War, the First World War. And so he knew he wanted to get accepted to the university. So what would that allow him to do then? He enlisted, but he would enlist as a what? An officer. So officer training school. So he gets into Oxford knowing he's not going to go to school, that he's immediately going to enlist in the army. And so he's only at Oxford maybe 2 weeks, and he's enlisted. Personal choice. Officer training school. And he goes on to officer training school for multiple months. That's where he meets Patty Moore. If you've all seen war movies, you know, got the bond over the training. If you've seen Band of Brothers, the very first episode of Band of Brothers is where they're bonding and they're meeting each other, and they there's an immediate bond with this young man named Patty Moore. And this is just crazy to me. If you're a student of World War I, he is sent to the front upon graduation, and he arrives at the Somme, S-O-M-M-E. He arrives at the Somme, and if you study World War I, know this. It was one of the worst places to be sent. He arrives at the Somme on his 19th birthday. Welcome to 19. At this time, 6,000 men, British men, a day were being slaughtered. 6,000 men a day. 9.5 million were eventually killed during World War I. 9.5 million. And it's in this time that he is severely wounded. The next year, in 1918, on April 15th, a British artillery shell, his own team, a British artillery shell falls short and lands in the trench where he and his mates are. His commanding officer is directly next to him, absorbs most of it, in which they could never find him after the effect. His best friend to the right of him is killed, and the left side of his body is filled with shrapnel. His left leg, his left arm, and into his lung. This is rarely talked about. He never talked about it. Lewis was intensely private about his life. And it's only through extant and other research that this is coming. It comes that he was severely wounded. But later on in his life, one of the only places he mentions it as a severe grace, because later on, in the weeks following, his entire company was wiped out. So because this artillery shell falls short, he gets wounded, he's sent, and it takes him 6 months to recover. 6 months. And to the point where he is discharged from the army and returns to study at Oxford. And so in 1919, he returns to Oxford, still recuperating. He finally transitions out of the army at the end of 19, but he's in Oxford at the time. And from 1920 to 1924, you know, in the English system, they read. It's called, they read for a BA. And so he was reading and getting lectured about for 4 years. But within those 4 years, he receives what's called three firsts. Three firsts. In other words, three bachelor's degrees, and which is unheard of. And they had ranking systems in the British system, and you knew where you ranked. and he received the highest in these three topics. Greek and Latin literature was the first. Philosophy and ancient history was his second first. And then finally, his last one is honors English. English literature was his third first. Unheard of. So he had this, and he went on then to teach until 1954. In 1924, he was accepted as a tutor of philosophy at Oxford for a year under his esteemed professor of philosophy, who got, I think he went to Harvard for a year. And so that tutor, he got elected to fill that tutor's role, in a recent graduate. Think of all your buddies. When you were in college and you graduated from college, think about then the next year, your best friend was then your professor. Or the top professor of philosophy. I mean, it was really strange for somebody that young to be allowed to be in that role. And so he taught philosophy. Most people don't think of Lewis as a philosopher. He's an English lit guy. He's English lit. In fact, he went on to write the Oxford Compendium volume on 16th century English literature. And so he's known as a lit guy, a word guy. But philosophy was woven throughout. He got a first in philosophy at Oxford. He taught it for a year. And then even there's histories of the people, the students who read with him in his career. Over half of them were all philosophy students. They weren't literature students. So he taught philosophy. He was lecturing on and tutoring in philosophy his entire career. So philosophy was embedded in what he did, even though he's known as a literature professor. So he's philosophically astute. And during this time, in 1929, he ascends to theism. He's like, okay, there is a God. And so this is during his time at Oxford when he's beginning his tutorship. And then finally, 2 years later, the famous story, which Dan did a good job of describing, he articulates that he became a Christian, which is kind of fun, on a motorcycle ride with his brother on the way to a zoo. He's like, when I got on the motorcycle with Warnie, I wasn't a Christian. And when we arrived at the zoo, I was. And it's just fun. It's fun to read his Surprise by Joy and some of this work of which he, you know, and there's much more to study. That's not what we're talking about, but I just wanted to include this so you understand, because it's going to make much more sense as we get into this text. So he becomes a Christian in 1931. So then this begins a very prolific period of printing, writing, radio broadcasts, and even a few sermons sprinkled in from 1933 to 1942, roughly a 10-year period. You have the Inklings. If you're familiar with Lewis, he had this group of literary thinkers, poets, writers, philosophers, even a rare local politician here and there that they would group together at the Eagle and the Child, the Bird and the Baby, this pub. They usually met in his rooms at Oxford, but if not, they were at the Eagle and Child pub, and they would just debate these issues. So the Inklings were engaged starting in this decade. You have his radio, his BBC dramatizations. You have him writing his famous book on pain, as in emotional, existential pain, called The Problem of Pain. You have him doing the BBC, you know, what became Mere Christianity, the book, was BBC engagement and interviews. You have Screwtape Letters in this time period, a serial publication. They were published, I think, weekly or monthly. Daniel, you probably know. They were published, and then the Screwtape Letters became a book, but they were published as individual stories in The Guardian, not The Guardian we know, the British newspaper, but a small religious pamphlet, also called The Guardian, confusing. And then he wrote Out of the Silent Planet, so his first in his space trilogy. How many of you have read any of his space trilogy? Awesome. That's less or more than I'd imagined. And then he creates the Oxford Socratic Club. So this decade is just a very rich, I mean, he's on the radio, he's writing books, he's writing pamphlets, he's on the lecture series, He's had several named lectureships. And in 1942, he's asked to give the Riddell Memorial Lectures at the University of Durham. I don't know which universities, obviously, you've all graduated from. Every university has these, but it's modeled on Oxford and Durham and these other universities giving named lectureships. And every year you get allowed to, you know, you get asked. And the high-end professors, they get asked to come and give these lectureships. And he was asked to come to the University of Durham, which is about 250 miles north of London, Oxford, and to give this lecture series. And it had to be on religion and society. Kind of broad, right? Religion and society. And so he writes three lectures. There was a three-night lecture from February 24th through the 26th of February in 1943. You sometimes see this was published in early 43, and that's a misnomer. This wasn't published till late 43 because the lectures hadn't even been given yet. So this was published after, and so the reason there are three chapters in The Abolition of Man is it literally is three meant to be oral, spoken lectures, lightly edited. This is what was given in those three nights. So the reason you have Men Without Chests, The Way, and The Abolition of Man, those three chapters, is because those were the three lectures night after night. He had record attendance. The first night, 542 people came to listen to his lecture. And it went down just a bit over the next two nights. But he had record attendance. The average attendance was like 150 to 200 at one of these. He doubled these lectures. Very well attended. But it was a lecture that was supposed to be philosophically, he knew his audience. Just like when you read Mere Christianity, the radio, the BBC presentations, he knew his audience. The written publications of Screwtape, he's writing in a publication, a serial publication, he knew his audience. Well, this is a philosophical writing, and so this is what I wanted to set up. He argues it's his most important work. And the more you read Lewis, the themes of abolition of man, I will argue, others argue this as well, the more I've seen it, I agree with it, I assent to it, this unlocks C.S. Lewis. If you understand the main theme of what he's trying to get across in the three-night lecture of abolition of man, you will understand C.S. Lewis. This is the key. Because this is what dominated his worldview. He said, this is how the world is, this is how I see it to be, here are the errors, and this is where I think we should go. But it's a different kind of thing. It's to a philosophically astute audience. He's assuming they could stick with him. That's why there's straight up Latin in it, he just quotes Latin and French in a few places, and you need a disciple. For those of us, you know, who are, our Latin's a little weak, there's a lot of guides now that what C.S. Lewis was saying is, you know, and they'll quote it in there, so we're like, oh, okay, that's what he meant. But he would just quote Latin and move on, thinking and knowing his audience would stick with him. They would know what he's saying. And so he loses people there a little bit. It's heavily, deeply philosophical. And what it isn't, this is what a lot of people struggle with. I just want to be very clear. This isn't a work of apologetics. And essentially, it's not even a Christian book. Okay, no mass exodus. Okay. I just wanted to give people a chance to leave, you know, if they had to. What he's arguing for is something even more fundamental. He says it blatantly in the third lecture. He has to just say this. Even though I'm a theist and indeed a Christian, this is not a Christian work. Remember, this is what he considers his most pivotal, most important writing. And this is what we get to play with. This is the field. I'm not going to answer it for you right now, why it isn't. But we're going to play in this for the next 3 weeks, 4 weeks, after the introduction. What does it mean? What is he after? Why did he choose to go this route? Because just because it isn't Christian doesn't mean it isn't true. And he was after, he's being playful here. But it is a little intense. And so he gives this lecture in 1943. And this idea dominated him at the time so heavily that he wrote, if you want a shorter version of understanding this, his essay called The Poison of Subjectivism was written that summer. So he writes the three lectures, and they knew it would be published. All of those lectures were compiled and published. So he knew it would be published to some degree, but this wasn't published till December of 43 because the Oxford University Press had to leave Oxford to London because they were going to get bombed out. The World War was going on. They leave. They couldn't get Oxford to print it. Finally, his publisher said, "Lewis, you're selling all this other work with OU, Oxford University Press. Badger them to get it printed." And finally, he wrote a little bit of a Lewisian nastygram, a very kind nastygram, and said, "Look, publish the work." So this wasn't even published till December 21st of 1943. But in the midterm, in the summer of 43, he writes an essay to a Christian audience explaining very similarly what he's doing here. So if you want to read a shorter work, The Poison of Subjectivism, you can find it online for free. Poison of Subjectivism. And at the time, even though he's writing at the exact time of this, he's writing Perelandra, his second in his space trilogy. What he argues later in life is that a year later, a year after this, the third book, how many of you have read Out of the Silent Planet? That is the fictionalized direct account of abolition of man. Oh, That Hideous Strength. Thank you. That Hideous Strength, yes. The third book, That Hideous Strength. Thank you guys very much. This is why it pays to have these guys here. The third book is That Hideous Strength, where you have the nice and the scientists and Mark Studdard and Ransom and this whole world that he builds fictionally is the abolition of man. He says that himself. So if you want to read three intellectual lectures, read Abolition of Man. If you want to read to understand him, read The Poison of Subjectivism in essay form. Or if you like more fictionalized accounts, and it helps to read one of these two and then That Hideous Strength. And so this dominated his writing, his thinking, his ideas very, very deeply. In fact, you'll hear echoes of this in the introduction to Mere Christianity. He lays out a very rudimentary framework of what's in the Abolition of Man very early in Mere Christianity as well. So this is the key to understanding C.S. Lewis. And there's three ways of looking at Abolition of Man. Several people have put it this way. He argues the first chapter, there's three chapters as past, present, and future. So the first chapter is the past. Second chapter is the present, what's going on at his time. And then the third chapter is very prophetic. We had a very prophetic sermon today. And let me just, don't we have a great shepherd? Isn't Andrew really does a great job. And I love his work. I love his preaching. And he was just in here a second ago, but he left. I would have said this whether he was in here or not. I found it interesting the way he tiptoed. Did you understand? He was almost like, okay, there's scary stuff in the Bible. There are bad people in the Bible. There are people in power who are bad in the Bible. There are people of Israel who are in power who are bad. And he tiptoed a little bit this morning. Why do we have to do that? Do we not know our scriptures and the evil and the reality of humankind and the sin? I mean, this is a part of scripture, people, justice and righteousness. And Lewis gets a little more intense, a little more prophetic in this third chapter. And so some people say past, present, future. Some authors have said this layers on to the philosophical concept of truth, beauty, and goodness. He hammers about truth the first lecture, using the foil of subjectivism, ethical subjectivism or logical positivism. We'll get there. Trust me. I don't want to lose you. I want to excite you for what's coming. The next 3 weeks, I'm just going to take a chapter a week, a lecture a week, and we're going to talk about it. And then one of the other authors also says this is the chapter one is the checkup. Chapter two is the diagnosis, And chapter 3 is the prognosis. So you have different people, you know, but there's three different ways. But he's definitely prophetic. He's definitely saying, look at the world. He's trying to identify a problem. Look at the world we're living in. And again, contextually, World War I had happened, and now they're in the midst of World War II, in Abolition of Man, just, you know, a short decade and a half later. And then he unpacks what he thinks humankind is. And that's why you get the famous quote or idea of men without chests is the topic of lecture or chapter 1. Men without chests. Chapter 2 is called The Way, in which he introduces, well, he briefly mentions it in lecture 1, but in lecture 2, he unpacks this Confucius, a proverbial Chinese writer. He introduces this idea of the Tao, T-A-O. It's not Tao, it's Tao. He introduces this Confucian idea of the Tao. And what, as Christians or people who study philosophy or theology, it's natural law. He introduces this concept and shows throughout multiple cultures the idea of the natural law was static. And people agreed and understood there was this idea of the natural law. And he just brings in philosophical quotes from Europe, from Africa, Asia, and he brings it all in a very interesting package in the second lecture. And then finally, prophetically, in the third chapter, he shows how, if what he argues is happening philosophically, the world of ideas leading into the world of practice, in politics, in business, in the world itself, will lead to ultimately where the title of the book comes from, the third lecture, The Abolition of Man. People who believe this way that he builds into, people who believe this way, the bulk of people do, he argues, believe this way, they will not cease to be man, or they won't be just defunct man, they will cease to be human. They will entirely become another thing. And again, if you've read That Hideous Strength, you kind of see some mirroring there. So it's very prophetic. So let's just start with chapter 1, just very briefly. I'm going to lay out some of the themes that we, again, next week, we'll just do all chapter 1, Men Without Chests. And so he starts this concept. Let me stop for just 1 second. What he's interested in getting us to see throughout the book is there this one main theme, that there is something called objective morality. There is something really real, but that it does not exist inside of you. Where does it exist? It exists outside. And it's our job to correspond our life, our emotions, our feelings, and our beliefs, our opinions. It's our job to correspond that with reality that is out there, not inside of me. That's that's the point he's trying to get across. That's why his essay in the summer that I mentioned earlier is called The Poison of Subjectivism. How many of you know or have seen, it's not to call you out, this isn't confession time, but The Big Lebowski? Have you seen The Big Lebowski, hilarious movie, right? And there's a famous scene in the bowling alley. Or no, it's not in the bowling alley. I think it's in his living room in the pit. But who's the actor? Jeff Bridges. Jeff Bridges is, you know, he's wearing that cardigan, that old man's sweater, and he's sitting there, and they're having an argument, and there's this, you can find it on YouTube, this clip, and he's like, well, that's just your opinion, man. It's just your opinion. And it's this very postmodern conversation. It's brilliant. It's hilarious. But that's how most of us live when we talk about ideas and we assert something that's true. Well, that's just your opinion, man. Is that true? Is he making a moral claim that that's just your opinion? Is his opinion about my opinion an opinion? And this just isn't a tautological argument. Lewis is wanting to play with, when we make claims about the world, are they really real? Are we trying to access something that's really real? Or are you merely a subjective, emotive individual? And what you're really talking about is your emotions about a thing, not the thing in and of itself. And this is how he opens the chapter. And that's a lot of authors will argue, people that look at this, you know, he's really worried. He introduces a book that's on his shelf in the very first paragraphs. And he goes, look, somebody sent me a book. It's authored by these two guys, and he doesn't name them. I'll name them for you next week. You can find it easily. But he names them Gaius and Titius, which essentially in Latin means the dudes, the men, guys. So very banal, right? The guys that wrote this book, Gaius and Titius, that introduces something at the junior high level to boys, at this time it was all segregated, young men, on learning this idea of subjective language. And he found this probably to be the worst sin out there, is how you teach your children about reality is the core principle for any parent, person, or teacher. How you approach and allow your students to understand what really is out there, whether it's true or not. So this is a work of metaphysics, this is a work of epistemology, and this is a work of applied ethics. But he doesn't use any of these big words. He doesn't use any of them in his writing. This is the mastery of C.S. Lewis. This is where his art of language comes in. He uses metaphor. The three lectures are full of metaphor, analogy, and trying to get his audience to see. But what he is smuggling in all throughout is standard metaphysics, epistemology, and applied ethics. And his audience would have understood that. Some of us maybe not so much anymore. And so in Men Without Chests, he starts with this analogy that they use in their book. Gaius and Titius write this book, and they say it's famous Coleridge, the artist Coleridge. He comes to a waterfall, and one person at the waterfall says, "This is sublime." What does sublime mean? Yeah, what else? Fantastic. What else? Perfect. I didn't hear it.
Indescribable.
It gives off the idea that thereafter, in their context, sublime means so full of grandeur and beauty that you are in awe. This thing in front of me is just full of grandeur and beauty. And the person next to that person that says it's sublime, they're like, that's pretty. This is what set Lewis off. That analogy set Lewis off to write a three-lecture series on the philosophical damnation of subjectivism. Because somebody looked and said, no, that is full of awe. That is beautiful. And somebody said, nah, it's just pretty. We laugh at that. But the mark of a well-trained mind is the ability to make distinctions. The mark of a well-trained mind is the ability to make distinctions. And I hope over the next 3 weeks, I can help pull out some threads to understand some of the distinctions that Lewis saw that maybe we don't. And to provoke us a little bit. He does get into some social concepts about the world, where it's easy to point, yeah, look at that. But he is an equal opportunity offender. He takes on communism, he takes on fascism, he takes on democracy. So he takes on this social idea, these ideologies, he says, but he also takes a very clear aim at you and I. It's a very personal book. It's not just about social structure or will to power, which he engages, Nietzsche. It's not merely about that. It's actually, more importantly, what he argues is about you and me. How do you view what is true? What is real? Because most of us have, like Jeff Bridges' character, from a day-to-day basis, we talk with people like, well, that's just your opinion, man. What are you wrong about? Some of you might think you're wrong about a lot. There's probably a spectrum here, right? Some of you might not think you're wrong about very little. Lewis, in another essay on reading old books, argues that you need to read at minimum, first he says 1-to-1. For every contemporary book, you have to read an older book written outside of the century in which you live, the century in which you live in. But he goes, if that's too much, maybe 1-to-3. For every 3 contemporary books, read an old book. And he says, because you need to let the clean sea breeze of the past blow through your mind. Because not that the past, people of the past, had any more access to truth than we did, but they go wrong in their own way. And we now have access to see how they went wrong. And that reminds you, and this is now the NIV version of the quote, so that you can look at your own life and understand you are going wrong somewhere right now. As an individual, as a culture, there is something wrong with what we're doing because we're human. Kind of like what Andrew was saying. I mean, the idea of Molech, the reason Molech is adopted and masked onto the current abortion movement, if you read much in some of the abortion writing, the idea of the sin and the idolatry of Molech, sometimes you'll hear that language when you read about abortion apologists or people engaging the topic of abortion. That's why what we just heard, the sin of Molech is sacrificing your children at altar. And like what he presented, right? It wasn't just a random thing that somebody heard once that was bad. It was endemic to the culture. They burned their children as sacrifice to their gods. That's pretty bad, right? So, are we doing much better? Lewis, in this essay, wants to write, what are we blind to? Where are we going wrong? And the more that we look internal to ourselves about my own opinions, my own feelings about things, the less I will have access and understanding to what is really real, true truth. And of course, there's a lot of philosophy that deals with it. Movies play with this theme, right? How do I access what is really real? And so he is directly attacking and engaging the topic of ethical subjectivism or logical positivism. And again, he never says this, that he doesn't, but those are the two ideas. And he had men that he taught with that were the leading thinkers in logical positivism and ethical subjectivism at Oxford. And so he had very direct people he was trying to attack. And when he did so, he always did it pseudonymously. Whatever that word is. He always intersected another word for their name, like Gaius and Titius, or we'll get to Orbilius later, and others. It's only when he's really, really incensed with somebody that he calls them out. So he kind of masks his ideas. There's these thoughts out there that, and then he goes, trust me, I have this book on my shelf, and then he goes on to describe this. But eventually he has such an anger intellectually that he just calls out names. That's why he started the Sorry, we had in Spokane, when I taught there, we had the Gonzaga Socratic Club, and it was modeled after the Oxford Socratic Club. But that's why he started the Oxford Socratic Club, was because they wanted people to out, like, let's bring up two opposing ideas. And this is what's missing in our modern world. We shun those who think differently than us, rather than expose it and bring it up. Like, let's bring it up. Let's talk. I mean, if you say you believe X, let's bring it up. Let's see somebody who believes Y, and we're going to work it out. We're going to talk it out so we can see it. And he was brilliant at doing this. And so in the first chapter, he uses the idea of the head, the chest, and the belly. This is why men without chests. It sounds weird. Men without chests, what is he after? Well, he argues, and again, we're going to unpack this all next week, but you have the head, the rational man, the head, the robot, in our modern language. You have the belly, the koilia, the passions. And he goes, if you ascend to bestial, beast, the belly, the appetites, you become like a beast. If you become rational and live in your head, you become just very automatic, robotic. You need a mediator between those two, because angels are rational but without bodies. Beasts are irrational but with bodies. You're not an angel or a beast. You're a man. You're a human. A human has a chest, and it's the liaison officer between the appetites and the rationality. And you need this liaison officer to understand what he again does. Aristotle's golden mean, the golden mean between excess and deficiency of a thing. And so the head, the chest, and the belly, he'll unpack and say, to be truly human, you need to be mediating the animal instincts, the rational instincts, with this liaison officer, the chest. And we'll unpack what he thinks that is. He ends the chapter with this quote: in a sort of ghastly simplicity, we remove the organ and demand the function. We make men without chests and expect of them virtue and enterprise. We laugh at honor and are shocked to find traitors in our midst. We castrate and bid the geldings be fruitful. He was anything if descriptive. So that's how he sets up the first lecture. Good night. And that's how that quote ends the first lecture. See you tomorrow night. And then the next night, he introduces this Confucian idea of the way, the Tao. And very briefly, I'll give you a taste of what that is. This thing which I have called for convenience, the Tao, and which others may call natural law, or traditional morality, or first principles of practical reason, or first platitudes. So he's quoting philosophy, he's quoting whatever you want to call this thing. It is not one among a series of possible systems of value. It's not one of. It is the sole source of all value judgments. If it is rejected, all value is rejected. If any value is retained, then it is retained. The effort to refute it, natural law, and objective truth, and raise a new system of value in its place is self-contradictory. That's from the middle of the chapter. And again, we'll unpack that week. But he's arguing that this Tao, this idea of the natural, it's not just one and among systems. It's the system. If you don't believe in objective value, what he then argues into the third chapter is you're inhuman. You're not really human. Lewis shifts to this prophetic mode. He says, for if morality is subjective and the Tao doesn't hold, as most people currently believe, then we're ushering in a post-human world. Some of you might, if you're in technology, it's an area of my specialty, we talk a lot about transhumanism. What's a transhumanist momentum look like? then you are transitioned into literally the, you are transitioning into the literal abolition of man. They become morally blind, and all that is left is will to power. And if you're familiar with that, he's referencing Nietzsche. All ideologies are susceptible to it. All of them, communist, democrat, fascist alike. Mankind, and in the second, the third chapter, he says, mankind has increasing power over nature. We conquest, so technology is what he turns to show the conquest of men. And he says, man's power over nature turns out to be a power exercised by some men over other men with nature as its instrument. Remember when he's writing, World War I introduced what? The machine gun, the tank, and gas. World War II introduced, even it's before, he's writing before this is introduced, but what was being worked on in World War II? Fat man and little boy, right? The hydrogen bomb, the first bombs. So contextually, you have to remember what he's seeing. Man's power over nature turns out to be power exercised by some men over other men with nature as its instrument. Man's conquest of nature, if the dreams of some scientific planners are realized, it means the rule of a few hundreds of men over billions and billions. This was 82 years ago. That's why some people, many people call this prophetic. And again, he is a equal opportunity offender. And so that's the third week. We're going to talk about the third lecture and this prophet and the way he just kind of mic drops. It's a little more, the third chapter is a little harder to discern. The first two are pretty clear. And the third one, we get into some areas that are a little more difficult. But this is why this is worthy of study. He argues this is the hinge, the pivot to all of his thinking, all of it, his Narnian thinking and what he's writing in there, the principles that come through, his idea of mere Christianity, his idea of pain, all of these things are wrapped up in this idea that if you do not believe in objective morality, you cease to be human. It's a pretty heavy thesis. But it's worthy for Christians to understand, just as it's worthy to understand what we heard today, that you and I do evil things, both systematically and individually. It's interesting that in the problem of pain, one of the major evil people in the problem of pain is a nagging old woman who nags herself to hell and likes it. So we can talk about big nuclear arms, we can talk about big bad Nazi fascism issues, but all throughout he shows how personally, yes, systems have issues, but personally, what are your issues? As my mother-in-law used to say, to be a nice old woman, you have to be a nice young woman. How much does habit play into this? How much does virtue, how is virtue taught? So as you can see, it's not merely about education. It's about a way of thinking that defines, ultimately, I would argue, corresponding to Christianity, and so does he, but in a way that is so unique that hopefully will help you talk to those around you who live as we currently do in a post-Christian world. Thank you. Welcome next week. We're going to hit chapter 1, Men Without Chests. Have a great day.